Welcome back to the I'm Moving to Italy podcast. This is Nathan Heinrich.
And I'm Vera Sarzano.
And we would like to welcome you back to Season 6, Episode 18.
So Nathan, you just got back home from Paris, France. I've been watching your posts and videos on Instagram, of course. And well, it looks like you had a blast, like too much of a blast, maybe because you were in France, but okay. So I want to know everything. Tell us about your experience there. And well, first of all, I want to know if you fell in love with Paris, like I think you did from the videos I saw, but yeah. And most importantly, how was food and how were the people there?
Okay, honestly, Vera, no one's more surprised than me at how charmed I was by Paris, truly. I had zero expectations. I wasn't even thinking about the city. I was so focused on just seeing my friends and spending time with them, I didn't even give any consideration to the location where we were meeting, really. But every inch of that city is beautiful, from the stones on the streets to the mansard roofs. There's beauty like everywhere you look in Paris. Not only is the architecture more beautiful than anywhere else on earth, but inside every little shop and restaurant and museum and hotel, there's even more beauty. And when I got home, Alessandro was less than enthusiastic to hear how much I loved Paris. He made me repeat, we're in the car driving back home here to Conegliano, and he made me repeat back to him after I told him all about how much I loved Paris, which city in Europe is the real location for the best food, best culture, best beauty, and of course the best people, which of course, in his opinion, is Napoli. That I even went to the Luxembourg Gardens, which you and I talked about in the last episode, and I took photos for you. It was great. That was really, really good advice. I'm so glad that you mentioned that. I was just amazed at how much I loved it. Everywhere I looked, everywhere I went, I walked so much. My legs got so tired. I was walking like more than 20,000 steps a day. My feet, my legs were so tired, but it was amazing. I didn't, until the last day I was there, I didn't really get down into the metro because I was just walking everywhere. And the last day I was there, I finally started using the metro, and then it was time to go back to the airport. But anyway, it was amazing. Are you going to come to Paris with me the next time I go? Alessandro's very, very anti-French and French people. Now, I want to know, do you feel the same way like all other Italians? Are you prejudiced against Paris and your cousins from the other side of the Alps, as you say?
Okay. I would love to come to Paris with you because I think Paris is one of the most amazing cities in the world and it's just so perfect. But yeah, I feel the same way Alessandro does because it's France. I mean, I love France, but I don't know. I'm kind of frustrated because it's France. You know, it's just something that you need to know our history and it's really complicated. But okay, Italians and French people don't get along. Okay, but France is a beautiful country and Paris is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And I've been to the French Riviera several times. I've visited Alsace, La Loire. I don't know how you say those in English, but the areas in France. And the city of Lyon, which is also beautiful and amazing. And yeah, it's beautiful, like full of beauty, like you were saying, right? So it's really, really every single detail. And it's everything you've always, you know, thought about France. It's just so iconic. But French people, yeah, I know you said you met the, you know, they were also lovely to you. And, you know, maybe it's a problem between us and them. Okay. Maybe they are lovely with you because you're clearly not Italian and your friends there were not Italian. Okay. Now, I believe that France is sort of like Italy. People in the north of France are really different from the people from the south of France. So basically, people from the south of France are more similar to Italians. Of course, it makes sense, right? Why people from the northern part of France are more European instead of southern European. Anyway, we are very similar. we have both this passion for food, amazing food and agriculture. Of course, we make our own vegetables and fruit and everything else, and all kinds of pate and salami and so on. So there's competition, you see. Now, until the 80s, probably. So actually a few years ago, if you think, you know, from an historical perspective, French was the only language, second language, taught in Italian schools. So my parents only studied French when they were in school. Not English was studied in Italy, because France was the main power, okay, in Europe, and we all followed them, and we all studied French. So French people used to come to Italy and could just speak French. We went there and sort of spoke French. But then, you know, English is the language, you know, all around the world, it's an international language. We started studying both, and then we sort of dropped French in favor of English. And so French people still come here to Italy and start speaking French to you. And you're like, And I have to be honest, I speak some French. I'm not great at it, but I do speak some French. I, you know, people understand me when I talk. And when those people just came up to me when I work at the castle and started speaking French, I pretended not to understand a single word, because at least try, at least ask me, do you speak any French at all? And then I'm more than happy to help you. I mean, I did guided tours in French, even though my French is not that great, but I was like, okay, if you don't understand any other language, I'll try. And I did. So I'm, you know, very open. But you cannot just come here and speak your language, because 50 years ago, everybody in Italy studied French. So that's sort of the point. And when we as Italians go there and start speaking English, okay, not Italian, but English with them, they just reply to you in French. So that is kind of rude. And also they correct your pronunciation. Now, if you think Italian pronunciation is difficult because we have a lot of vowel sound, like it's carnevale and not carnivale, but just try French, because they have all this masculine and feminine. So it's, you know, it's difficult, like Italian, but with more struggles, I think, with pronunciation. So maybe I try to say something like, I would like a glass of water, and water is one of the most difficult words to pronounce in French, and they correct you. I mean, you understood what I want. You really need to correct me. I was already, you know, trying. But I think they do it with us because we are Italian and we're supposed to speak French because they were ruling here. While you Americans, Canadians, Dutch, German, you go to France and maybe they're like, oh, so sweet, a German who tries to speak French, and they help you. And this is everything I have to say about, no, I love the niche. And I would, you know, I would love to be French, in fact. But now that I'm Italian, I just can't not. I mean, it's French. And, well, the food is way better in Italy. There, I said it.
I love it. I didn't want some politically correct answer from you. What I love about you being part of this podcast is that you bring it to us the way it really is, because I don't want to hear the perfect, the way it's supposed to be version. I want to hear the way real Italians feel. And I think you're a very good representation of how Italians in general feel about French people. I had really, really good conversations with three people in Paris. One of them was a taxi driver named Bruno. I don't remember exactly. There's a French pronunciation of his name, but anyway, in English, it's Bruno. We talked for 30 minutes, and it was one of the best conversations I'd ever had. And he was talking to me about the farmers, the French farmers that are revolting, and all the problems that the French people have with the European Union right now, and just all kinds of things. And we just had the best conversation. He was so lovely. I turned around a corner. I was looking, searching for a cab because I was trying to rush to dinner to meet my friends. And I knew I couldn't walk the whole 2 miles that it was going to take to get to the restaurant. And I came around a corner, and there's a taxi cab sitting there with its green light on. I waved to him. I jump in. He'd been having a hard time all day finding people to ride in his taxi. And so we were just chatting in English, of course, and we had the best conversation. He really shared how he really felt. He was enjoying the conversation, and so was I. So that was my really only conversation with a true Parisian. And then I met a girl at my hotel who was from Lyon, and she had moved to Paris, she said something really interesting to me. She said, you know, I've only lived here for about 9 months. And she's like, here in Paris, of course, Parisians have a reputation for being rude. And she's like, I'm feeling myself becoming rude. She's like, I was never rude. I'm from Lyon and I was never felt this way. But now that I'm in Paris and I'm feeling myself become a Parisian because, yeah, we're trying to get somewhere quickly on the metro, or we're in line to go somewhere and everyone around us doesn't know what they're doing. They're snapping pictures. They're going slow. They don't understand. They don't speak or read French. And she's like, we just get frustrated because we can't do what we're trying to do because everywhere you look, there's a tourist acting stupid. But we had such a good conversation. And then I met another guy named Jarek, and he was from Poland, but he'd lived there for like 15 years. And so, yeah, I guess I met a lot of people in Paris who weren't necessarily from Paris originally. And maybe you're right. Maybe they thought I was from Norway or, I don't know, somewhere else, some other country that they tend to like people better. I don't know. I had a pretty good experience in Paris, but thank you for sharing how you really feel about the French and the Parisians. And I'm going to try to have you and Luca and Alessandro and I all go to Paris someday and then really give it one more chance and see, can we have a good time? Can you enjoy yourselves? Can those French people behave and treat you with respect? We'll have to just give it a try.
No, but I know for a fact that, I mean, I've been to Paris already, and I was very young, though. I know I will love it. But it's just this thing with the French. You just cannot change things. I mean, we are Italian, so that's how it is. But are you ready to say all this in Italian now?
I can't say all of this in Italian, but I will say, how about if I say some of what we just talked about in Italian?
Okay, deal. Now, before we start, I have two keywords and two idioms for you today. Now, the first keyword is incantare, incantare. It's a verb. This is not very difficult. You know, there's the word incanto in there. So like enchanting, so something very beautiful that sort of amazes you. We use the verb incantare, so to charm someone. We have a synonym for that. So when something is so, so beautiful that you're like in awe and you can't even speak and you're there looking at it. And we use the verb rapire, rapire, which literally, and I love this, means to kidnap. So basically, if something is so beautiful that kidnaps you, it's like there's nothing you can do. You're just under their power. So this is, you know, can go with cities. So Napoli mi ha rapito. So Alessandro is happy that I use Napoli as an example, right? Napoli mi ha rapito. It means that I was kidnapped by Naples. So I was in their power. There's nothing else I can do in the world but to follow that city and just be so, yeah, probably kidnapped with some of the Stockholm syndrome, but you get what we mean. So we use the verb to kidnap to say that something is so beautiful that steals your soul. Right. Why? As for idioms, one is a braccia aperte, usually is accogliere a braccia aperte. So to welcome with open arms, like ready to hug you. This is nice. And sort of the opposite. So when two people or two nations don't get along very well, we say non scorre buon sangue. So tra l'Italia e la Francia non scorre buon sangue. So good blood does not flow there. So there's bad blood. There's some, you know, blood. Yeah. So let's see if you can find and hear where we use those two keywords and two idioms in our conversation. Mm-hmm. Allora, Nathan, sei appena tornato da Parigi. Ho visto i post, ho visto i video che hai pubblicato su Instagram. E mi sembra che tu ti sia divertito un sacco. Allora, raccontaci com'è andata, dai. Ti sei innamorato di Parigi? Come si mangia in Francia e come sono i francesi?
Credimi, dico sul serio. Non mi lo aspettavo, proprio invece Parigi mi ha rapito. Non sapevo che cosa aspettarmi dalla città. anzi non ci ho proprio pensato. Ero talmente focalizzato sul fatto di vedere i miei amici e di poter passare del tempo con loro che non mi sono minimamente interessato al posto. E invece dal momento in cui ci ho messo piede a quando ho ripreso l'aereo, Parigi non mi smesso di incantarmi. Ogni angolo della città è stupendo, di una bellezza straordinaria. Tutti si lamentano perché i parigini sono maleducati, ma io ho incontrato persone stupende che mi hanno accolto a braccia aperte. Quando sono tornato a casa, Alessandro non era per niente contento del fatto che mi fossi innamorato di Parigi e mi ha fatto ripetere ad alta voce che la più bella città europea è ovviamente Napoli. Visto che Alessandro è così antifrancese, vieni tu con me la prossima volta? O anche tu hai tutti questi pregiudizi contro i cugini di Alto Alpe?
Allora, vengo molto, molto, molto volentieri con te, ma anch'io questi pregiudizi, sì. Perché tra italiani e francesi non corre buon sangue, ma la Francia è un paese meraviglioso e Parigi è una delle città più belle del mondo. Io sono stata tante volte in Costa Azzurra, ho visitato l'Alsazia, la Loira, sono stata a Lione ed è stato tutto stupendo, ok? Davvero. Ma i francesi vogliono parlare solo francese e in Italia si mangia meglio, mi dispiace.
Oh my goodness, how funny. I love it. I kind of just love standing back and watching the French and the Italians duke it out. It's kind of funny. Thanks for sharing that with us, Vera. We'll have to discuss Paris and the French again in future episodes. Well, let's get into today's interview with my incredible guest who you are going to absolutely love her. She is one of the coolest people I've ever met. She is one of the most talented, original people. One of the wonderful things about interviewing people who have made the move to Italy, especially over 10 years ago, like Victoria has, sort of gives you something to look forward to. Without further ado, let's jump right into my interview with Victoria Walsh from Canada, now living in the mountain region of Trentino Alto Adige. Welcome, Victoria. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
I was convinced I wasn't going to find anybody to interview from the region of Trentino Alto Adige. And here we are talking to Victoria Walls, who moved to this region from where?
From Canada. I'm from a very small town about 3 hours from Toronto, 3 hours from Montreal. So central, eastern Canada.
Victoria, we're really, really, really pleased to have you here today. You've got a wonderful story that I'm really looking forward to having you share with us. The region that you live in, Trentino, which most people just call it Trentino, right? People don't say the whole name very often, right?
Well, there's Trentino Alto Adige is definitely its name, the province's name, but the people from Trentino just call it Trentino and the people from Alto Adige just call it Alto Adige. There definitely is a divide. And I actually live on like just 5 kilometers from the divide, basically. 5 kilometers north of me, they speak German as their first language.
A lot of people don't understand this, I think, about this region, that it's one region split kind of into two parts. Can you just briefly talk about what that means? Like, describe what that even means.
It has a lot to do with history that as a foreigner here, I don't feel that I can exactly weigh in on its political stances, but it is two regions that definitely both for the majority feel like Italy, but it is two regions that were pulled in different directions throughout history as one and as themselves individually. And it's always so amazing to be learning about it. You know, like every castle you see, everything is just mind blowing here, and but holds at the same time so much history. As a region, I would say it's like a young region of Italy in a way, because it has been unified after many years of being very separate.
Yeah, I find this whole region to be fascinating. Of course, later in this episode, Vera, who is my wonderful Italian co-host, is going to be talking about this from the perspective of an Italian, and she will be able to share things that you and I, as relative newcomers to Italy, probably don't know. So it's nice to hear your perspective on that. Back to you. You grew up in a little town outside of Toronto. Now, how did this journey begin for you?
Well, to be honest, it wasn't Italy. For me, it was just Europe. I've always loved history, and I just wanted it to feel different. And I moved out of my parents' house to go to university in Montreal, and I had finished my degree in Montreal, and then I moved to Toronto. And I lived in Toronto for a couple of years and was managing a hotel there. And I was so young. I was 22, and I realized I could be managing a hotel forever, and so I quit. And I moved to Europe just for a couple of months to travel around, and then people started talking to me about TESOL and becoming an English teacher, and so I went back to Canada and I got my certifications, and then I got my first English teaching job in Spain, which was the country that I really, for some reason, fell in love with. And then I met my now partner in Spain there. So that's what first introduced Italy to me, was him.
Okay. So romance is what really brought you to Italy then.
I know. I'm embarrassed to say because it's so cliche.
Don't be embarrassed. I think a lot of people would kill to be in your shoes and have the opportunity that you had. Now, what is your husband's name?
Giulio.
Okay. So where originally is Giulio from? Is he from this region of Trentino?
His family is, and he was born and raised in Rome. Him and his brother were born and raised in Rome, but his family, the Martinelli family, is from the Trentino region. So this, where I'm living now, has been something in their family for five generations.
Now take me from... You meet your future husband in Spain while you're teaching English. What happened next?
Well, to be honest, he was studying his MBA and was finishing that up. And his brother had been studying enology here at the University of San Michele. That's just across the river from us. And his brother was trying to convince him to come here and take a look at the old family property and think about reopening the winery with him. And Giulio and I came here together my first time, and now it feels like a blur a decade ago, but it was a completely different place than it is now. No one had touched the property basically for 40 years, 50 years. The doors just remained closed of the winery. There were farmers who lived on the property taking care of the vineyards. I came here, I looked at it and was like, no, I'm not going to live here. This seems crazy. I don't understand what's going on here. It's very dirty. And I got a teaching job in Poland. And Giulio and I kept seeing each other while I was living in Poland. We met up throughout the year. I continued liking him. I couldn't shake him, I always say. And then liking him convinced me to get a teaching job in Trento, which is a nearby city. And so I started living with him for a year and teaching at an English school here. And then I stayed. Not really, because I've always been on the move. Since then, you know, I've done many different harvests and wine vintages in lots of different countries. So I kept moving. I've honestly haven't been here all 12 months of any year. but this has been my home base for 10 years now.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you couldn't shake Julio. Is Julio named after the great grandfather?
The person he was kind of named after was Guido, but the name fell out of fashion, as the Italians would say, and it became Julio.
Okay. We're going way back to the 1860s.
Yeah, that's when the winery was founded, but the production really slowed after World War II. Then Julio's grandfather moved to Rome and was a pilot for Alitalia. That's where his father was raised and had a business, and that's where they continued to live there while keeping the vineyards and everything functioning here and always making a small amount of wine for the family here. But the winery itself was making millions and millions of liters at one point in time. Well, for a long period of time, actually, for almost 100 years. So it's a massive property that kind of closed down, but mostly after the war, economically, was not functioning.
Tell me about how you go from, I'm not doing this, and I'm running off to Poland to be a teacher there because this is a dirty winery and it's too overwhelming for me, to then move back to Trento and you're a teacher there because you can't shake this Italian love that you've got. How did you go from that to now the winery open and you're there, sitting there now in that winery talking to me, and you're part of the winemaking production? Like, that's kind of a 180. Tell me about how that happened.
Well, very carefully. I have always restored antique boats with my dad, and I've always been a very hands-on person. I think part of me saying no at the beginning, introspectively, was that I wasn't ready to stop moving, and that this winery forced me to stop moving because it was such a project that we really needed to, like, feet on the ground, hands in the cement, quite literally, and just physical labor because we had to redo the whole property. And I think I wasn't ready for that. I'm very happy to work with my hands and do physical labor, but completely leaving teaching wasn't exactly what I wanted to do at the time. And we've always joked that those first years, the first 4 years, we were more muratori, or like, we were more masonists than winemakers, because in 2013, the winery officially started making wine again for public sale, and we made 1,000 liters. And we basically doubled from there every year. So we were working in 2013 with 2 barrels of wine, like an extremely tiny production. We had to start underground. One of the reasons I started falling in love with it and wanting to stay was working with people who were able to tell us the history as we were demolishing things. And I have a jackhammer. You know, someone just hands me a jackhammer one day, and I always say that like 3 months, I just had that jackhammer in my hands. Like, it didn't go down. But learning from the people what the types of Malta were in the layers that they were talking about, it was always so fantastic to me. Like, you know, in Canada, we don't have this kind of history that I'm redoing the Barricaia, the cellar underground. It's from the 1100s. And the specialist that we had come in work with us, he was telling me about every layer of Malta, like why the stones were certain ways, how the water flowed around the mountain before this structure was built, why it was built certain ways. So I think I really fell in love with that, and that I became attached to it. You know, once you start working with your hands on things, you just, I become attached, at least I do, obviously. I couldn't let go of it after that. And yeah, I fell in love with the structure. I fell in love with the story. I found myself talking to his, crazy as it sounds, I found myself talking to his ancestors, like, in my head, like, hoping they were happy with what we were doing, how the property was changing, because it is a lot for people. We are in Trentino. This is a very traditional place. And the fact that 2 Romans and a Canadian came in and started jackhammering things, you know, people probably weren't that happy about it. Some people, anyways. But I became really attached to the cantina, and And we had our own little bubble, our own little community. It was us and like five friends underground for almost a year, redoing that space that is now our main barrel room. And then we moved into the two back rooms where our main wine production rooms. And we had a friend, Henry, who came from England, and he stayed with us for 3 months, and him and I just worked on those beams and re-cemented the whole place back there. And it really was like, I don't want to call it a commune, but it was our own little bubble, our own little world that we were building. It's definitely a group mentality. I find Italians have much more of a group mentality in general. The more the merrier, you know, like you go to a birthday dinner in Rome and there's 35 people at that table. That is not a typical Canadian birthday dinner. We didn't have real jobs, quote unquote. So we made this our real job.
Oh, wow. I love that. That sounds so romantic. You must now, looking back on it, realize that that was a fabulous time.
Yeah, it feels like a lifetime ago, for sure, because, you know, so much happens in 10 years and nothing at the same time. You know, I think it's the people and the stories behind wine. I had to get deeper into that, and I so fell in love with wine. I always say wine took a piece of my heart, because I love winemaking so much, and the wine communities all over the world. I think it's the coolest. And all over the world, winemaking is exactly the same. It's not exactly the same, but it's, you know, it's the same. If you can make wine in Italy, you can make wine in New Zealand, you can make wine in South Africa, you can make wine in Canada. It's so cool that wine is its own language.
That's a really interesting way of putting it. Wine is its own language. I like that. So you mentioned that you traveled around and had experience making wine and fall in love with winemaking in different places. Where were some of those places that you made wine?
The first place was South Africa. And then I went to New Zealand. And then I worked in Canada for a year in a cellar in Canada too. My plan was five different countries, but then the old pandemic happened. And I was like, maybe I'm too old for this now. Okay, I'll do something else.
Have you got it all out of your system, or do you still have kind of that wandering soul and desire to go do things other places?
I take a lot of weekend trips. I mean, I guess so. I've gotten it out of my system to move places. I'm really in love with my house. It's hard enough to be a lot in Canada. So I've gotten it out of my system that I want to sleep in other beds all the time. I like my own bed. But I definitely travel a lot, especially in Italy, and just will go away wine tasting. Or I was just in Modena for the last 2 days doing a self-imposed educational weekend of balsamic vinegar, because I didn't know that much about balsamic vinegar, traditional balsamic vinegar. So I spent 2 days going to vinegar houses and educating myself on it.
So did you do this on your own? You said self-imposed. Did you basically just go and learn about this on your own, or did you go with an organized group?
Oh, no, I just did it by myself. I just didn't do that kind of thing. You know, you eat well in Modena. It's a quick 2 hours drive away, and spend 2 days talking to people and going to different vinegar houses. I mean, I do that a lot with wine too. And I think that's part of my, like, how I fell in love with winemaking, because it allowed me to travel like that. And because after every winemaking season, then of course you have to do a 3-week holiday where you're just going wine tasting for 3 weeks, right? So that's a big part. Wine tourism is a big part of my passion and our passion here at the winery, here at my winery in Trentino. We're very enthusiastic about wine tourism and kind of cultivating that, getting it started in Trentino, because honestly, 10 years ago, wine tourism in Trentino was not happening. No one had tasting rooms. No one had like walkthrough tours. Now it is a thing and it's becoming more and more popular. So it's just really nice to be able to share at the place that you make the wine, your wines. You know, it's so different than doing a tasting at a bar or in a different country.
You just mentioned about wine tourism. Now, you have a website where you actually have written quite a bit about wine tourism. Can you share with us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I started that as a place to write down what I was learning about wine as I toured different places, writing wine guides. I started writing them for other websites, just freelancing. And then I decided to put them all into one place. So I write a little bit about wine production and things I learned in the cellar. For example, my experience with pet gnats and trying all different styles, different wines as a pet gnat this year, and kind of conclusions that led me to as a winemaker. And then I write a bit about the main grapes of different regions and itinerary for them or a jumping off point. So you don't walk into wine tourism feeling stupid or like you don't know anything, you know. And I find people are so overwhelmed by wine because it is a crazy huge world that no one can ever know everything about. And there's so many facets of wine. You just kind of want to help people cultivate people's love for it or interest, you know, because there really is a wine. I believe there's a wine for everyone. And you don't want people to feel intimidated to ask any questions or not know something basic, quote unquote, you know. So I just like to lay things down, what I wish I knew in that situation. And then you can find out as much as you want or as little as you want when you visit. But wine tourism really is the best way to learn.
Now, what is the name of that website where you do that writing, Victoria?
That's tortravelsforwine.com. T-O-R, travelsforwine.com. And I write a little bit about olive oil. I'm going to write something on balsamic vinegar next. So it's not just wine, but that's really where I am right now in my personal education. So I'll write it down anyways, even though it's not directly wine.
Okay, so tortravelsforwine.com is the site. We'll be linking that, of course, in the notes for this episode. So you can go read some of the wonderful things that Victoria is writing about wine and now balsamic vinegar.
I don't know how much you know about balsamic vinegar, but it really is so cool. It's so cool. You have to go to some. It's a wild process, and they're always in the attic of the house, and they remain in the attic of the house for a minimum 12 years. So you go up into these houses, into these villas, into their attics that just are filled with small barrels of vinegar. It's really wild, beautiful, beautiful. All the barrels, and they're always open. They stay open year round with all the windows open, so they can ferment all summer in the heat and then evaporate all winter. They just have a piece of cloth over their opening. It's really wild, for sure. Go check them out.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to definitely do that. You're kind of expanding my understanding of this because I had no idea. That's very interesting. I can see why you are passionate about that. Now, are you more interested in it for your other business where you export Italian food to Canada? I want you to share about that with us. Or are you also interested in making vinegar yourself?
Well, I do believe now I have to start making vinegar. And my partner said that to me. He was like, well, now I have to get barrels and put them in the attic. So yes, I probably will start making vinegar. But it's dangerous to make vinegar around where wine is made because of the bacteria. So you don't want them, any of the acetic bacteria picked up by the wines because they can start acetic fermentation. So you definitely need to keep them far away from that in another building or something. But I will definitely start playing around with how and where I'm going to make vinegar. And I think I did want to start importing a vinegar if I found one at the right price point that I think would work well in the Canadian market, the channels that I'm in. But I also just want to learn everything about Italian cuisine. And that is a lifelong a lifelong passion of mine, because that's the thing about Italian food. And I was just at a slow wine fair, a slow food fair, and it really is slow food. Like, Italy is slow food. You're talking about making a vinegar that's 25 years old. Like, it's just mind-blowing, especially, I think, as a North American, the way I was so used to everything being ready for me all the time. And, you know, if you didn't have asparagus, it's like, the store doesn't have asparagus. What the hell? Like, there should be asparagus. I'm having salmon tonight. But it's so different here. And I've learned so much about food and ultimately about our bodies and the earth and, you know, the environment because of the way Italians educate themselves about food. They're so into it, and I think it's a beautiful thing. So I went to learn about vinegar because it's so cool and it's so Italian, but I also wanted to find one for my company because I only import really specialty things. So I didn't want to just, you know, choose one just to have a balsamic vinegar available. I wanted to go talk to the families and see exactly what they were doing, how much they produce, making sure it's cool.
You're searching for not only for yourself to learn how to make balsamic vinegar, but you're looking for it to export to add to this amazing business that you have where you export Italian food to Canada. Can you tell me about that? How did that get started and what does that look like?
I'm independently importing specialty goods that I find from small farms all over Italy. So I went to an olive farm a few years ago and I was like, I love these olives. They're my favorite olives. I have to bring them to Canada. And the same with hazelnuts from Piemonte, from Piedmont. So it's all farms that I've been to that I want to share with Canadians. And they are very specialty, high quality products, of course, because they're not big cooperative, big box things. And they're my hand-picked products to be able to make authentic things in Canada from Italian products. I really fell in love with olive oil. I feel like wine kind of led me into olive oil because they're often in books together, at fairs together. And then I started really learning about olive oil and how no olive oil is what it says it is. And I became very passionate about olive oil and researching it. And the world of olive oil is so corrupt. It is extraordinary. You can buy olive oil in Canada for $2.99. And the cost of olive oil this year in Italy is 14 euros a liter. So something's gone amiss. To say it lightly. And yeah, so I started importing a small farms olive oil, actually two small farms, one from Abruzzo and one from Tuscany, that are direct to consumer pure olive oil that is pressed at the local frantoio and then shipped directly to Canada as a very pure and authentic small farm olive oil. And from there it kind of grew into other things that I like, that I had requests for. So I always go check out the farm, meet with the people, and then bring in these products to Canada.
All the Canadians, and we do have a number of Canadians listening, they're probably very happy that one of their fellow Canadians is doing this. And what is, just so people can find this website, it's just to be clear, the name of the business is Gamma Import Company. And is it correct? Your website is gammaimportco.com. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Gamma Import Co. And I also sell through specialty shops in most of the major cities in Ontario right now and then do orders for the rest of Canada.
Okay, now Gamma is spelled
G-A-M-M-A. In Italian, okay, it means range.
Okay, G-A-M-M-A importco.com is the website. Switching gears just a little bit, you're in this region. We kind of mentioned earlier that you're in this region that a lot of people have never even heard of. They don't really know much about this region. Now, it doesn't sound to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but it doesn't sound to me like this would have been your region of choice, maybe. If you had to choose any region in Italy to move to, you may not have chosen the one that's the very farthest north that you can possibly go in Italy. But now that you've lived in this region for more than 10 years, what do you love about the region where you live?
Well, you're right about that. I might not have chosen this, but I do love to ski. So I love the mountains for sport. I don't always love the mountains when they steal my sunsets because I'm a big sunset girly as well. But for sport, the mountains are incredible. I think that's its biggest tourism, or historically that has been the biggest tourism of Trentino Alto Adige. But what I love about it now, I couldn't live anywhere but a small town anywhere. So I probably would have moved to a big city, and knowing myself now, I would have moved out of a big city pretty within a few years of living there. But it's interesting because everybody finds it so rural here, and I find it quite packed with people for it being rural, because I'm from Canada where you know, rural is really rural. But here, you drive 3 kilometers and there's another town of 5,000 people, and you drive 5 kilometers that way and there's a town of 5,000 people. And so I find it quite populated. Like, it's not that rural. So it has amazing rural aspects, full of nature, full of outdoor activities. But then at the same time, you have towns and bars and things to do, clubs, cinemas, everything, everywhere. So it's an interesting mix for me, because I really find it not like living in the middle of nowhere in the country, whereas Italians would probably tell you this is in the middle of nowhere in the country. But I love my house here. I love my winery the most. And then the hike and skiing is good too.
You're doing a really good job of making this little known region sound pretty fabulous. By the way, for those of you that are listening to this, I want you to know what I'm looking at right now. I'm looking at this room that Victoria is sitting in. By the way, Victoria is this gorgeous redhead. She has the most fabulous head of red hair. It's the most perfect color, her natural color. She looks like one of those paintings from the Renaissance period. She's gorgeous. No, it's true, but tell me about this. You said now twice that you love your house, and I can see old beams going through. It looks like these beautiful sort of cream-colored walls and these beautiful old wooden beams. Tell me about this house that you live in and that you love.
Well, this is one of the buildings. We built like a house inside a part of one of the buildings here. So all the buildings are from different... I'm also like looking at the winery building. If I turn you around out my window, but the buildings were built in the 1500s, 1300s, 1400s, and kind of all added on throughout history that are on the property. So this building was one of the later built ones, but we just sectioned off a portion of it and built a house in there. But when I say my house, it's really the winery. It's the property, and in Mezzacorona, in this town in general, we have a lot of wineries, and always like every winery has a big courtyard. It definitely is. It's a vibe. Everybody's got a courtyard, and then all your gardens. We have lots of bunnies running around and chickens and a sheep that I don't like, but he's there. It's a great mix of like history, nature. And then, of course, here, why I love it, as I've been saying, is like we've done everything ourselves. So we did all of the work of our houses. You know, I really didn't like being an electrician. I have to say that's my least favorite job. But we've done everything throughout the years, everything in the winery and in our houses. So it's really mine. You know, like it feels really like home. And the only thing about Trentino is we need more flights going into Verona.
That's a really good point. You just mentioned Verona, which means that's the airport that you fly in and out of usually.
Yes.
How is that airport to fly out of? Where are the majority of the flights going from there?
They're going to Germany. So they're always going to Frankfurt or Munich, pretty much always. I often get flights to Canada, but they will first go to Munich or Frankfurt. And that's like an Air Dolomiti flight. So some years it's been really good. There's been lots of flights in and out. Other years, not so much. You know how these like smaller airports work. They're never steady throughout the years. Some years they're booming, other years they're not. But Verona is really, I mean, all over the airport, it says the gateway to the Dolomites. So it is the only option unless you're going to Munich and then taking the train down. But in that case, you change train systems from the German system to the Italian system. So it can become confusing.
Okay, so people from Germany then are flying into, well, maybe they're connecting in Germany and flying down to Verona because they're coming for, would you say, winter sports and skiing primarily?
Oh, yeah. They're coming for skiing, yes. All around, there's every half an hour, there's another ski slope, and they're coming to ski, or they're going to Milan and then coming up for like 2 days of wine tasting or 2 days of hiking kind of thing, because in theory we're close to Milan, but there is a mountain range between Trentino and Milan, so it's more than 2 hours to get here. I definitely find it easier to fly into Venice, like we were talking about before, just because it's more of a direct lineup.
Absolutely. I haven't yet flown out of Verona, so that's good to know. Now, would you say there are fewer flight options available during like the spring, summer, and fall months?
Yes. Lufthansa flies to Verona only in the winter time, I believe, or like fall through winter, less in the summer. But then all of the airports in the south are flooded with flights, but they don't have flights to all winter if you're going to Palermo and all the southern places. But I think year round here, we get a lot of tourism. Throughout the summertime, we get a lot of tourism by car. People driving down from northern parts of Europe to come to Lake Garda. That's a really big attraction. So where I am specifically is great to pass through because it does have its own highway exit and you're kind of halfway all the time to everything.
Before we go any further and I ask you anything else, I want to make sure that I share with the listeners who are now so eager to know about the name of your winery and how they could find your winery and order some of this amazing wine that has been, the history goes back to 1860. Can you tell us the name of your winery and a little bit of the history of the winery itself? I mean, you already kind of touched on it, but anything else that you'd like to share about the winery and then maybe the website of the winery so people could find your wines?
Sure. The winery is Cantina Martinelli, and that's cantinamartinelli.com. So it is historically a family winery and remains in the family now, the sixth generation. And it was reopened in 2013 by two brothers and myself. And we started with a very small production and then have tripled our production, quadrupled our production, but we still remain a very small winery. We produce under 30,000 liters. Our main grape that we produce is Teroldego, which is definitely a lesser known grape. And most of my wine life is explaining what Teroldego is and how a Canadian ended up making it. So we aim to make Teroldego, a traditional Teroldego, in a modern way. And Teroldego is a DOC grape of this region. It's only within this like 5 kilometers squared. It's a red wine, very high, like fruit, very round, very bold grape. We also make Chardonnay and from that Trento DOC Spumante, which is our traditional method up here from Trentino. So one of the things that Trentino has put a lot of efforts in is its sparkling wine community and Trento DOC, and Chardonnay is the highest planted grape of this region. So we make a sparkling wine traditional method that is all hand scourged completely by hand. Still just the three of us in the cellar. My partner and myself make the wine, and Andrea, his brother, is the oenologist. We have a couple of helping hands during harvest, but it's just us in the cellar. And yes, also from this region, there are 9 other wineries. We're in a group called the Troldigo Evolution, which there are 9 other wineries also making Troldigo. And we're all young winemakers from historic wineries. One thing that this particular town is very famous for, and you see it all outside of Italy, is its cooperative wine. The valley here is completely covered in vines, and all of our vines grow in pergola, grown overhead in pergola. I'm looking out now and I can see only vines, but 90% of those vines, those grapes that are produced there, go to the cooperative. So the region became wealthy or well off economically because the cooperatives in the 80s took over in the 70s and 80s, and they pay a high amount per grape, per ton of grapes. So we're kind of taking the grapes back from the cooperatives, because most people just grow grapes to go into this big bulk, big tank of wine and they produce millions of liters. And so we're taking that back from them and trying to take the name of Troldigo back from the cooperative that was once known as only a cooperative wine. And now we're making it like artisanal, high quality, and varying different styles.
What has been the reaction from the powers that be in the cooperative for you, as you literally said, we're taking it back? Has that been well received, or have you had some resistance to that?
There's definitely some resistance, like every good thing. There's been some resistance in understanding, because, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And when you're used to a wine costing €2 a liter or €1 a liter, even now asking €15 for a bottle just blows people's minds too far out. They can't handle that idea. And there's also some resistance from big guys, so to speak, that they don't want to change their regulations because, of course, they're producing volume, and we're kind of going against producing volume because that creates grapes in lower quality. But Troldigo itself, the vine, he wants to produce so much. He is a producer, you know. The grapes themselves come in bunches that can be more than a kilo each bunch. I go through the vineyard. I do a lot of the vineyard work in spring, and I go through and thin the grapes more than 4 times a season. He just keeps producing and producing and producing. Like, you can get such volume from him, and his berries are very, very juicy. And so it is a great wine for them to produce in this sort of volume production. It all went well in the line. I have to go through and cut out grapes several times through the year, like I said, but I first start with all the little shoots. I take out any doubles, then I have to go back in and do that again because they continue going crazy. Then I take down whole bunches more than twice, and then before harvest you have to go through again and you're just cutting down. That's actually why I started making grape jelly out of those. And one of our products that we sell here is grape jelly, because I was cutting down so many grapes, I just couldn't throw them on the floor anymore. So I had to start making jam out of them. And now we produce grape jelly. Italians had never heard of grape jelly, so a little Canadian thing in there.
Have you introduced them to peanut butter as well, so that they can have a peanut butter and grape jelly sandwich?
Well, peanut butter is hard to find also. I should probably start making my own. I have to find some sustainable peanuts. But our fridge is completely full of Reese's peanut butter cups. My partner is addicted to those, so I have to come home with lots of kilos of those.
Oh my goodness. Okay, so in the course of this conversation, I have heard you say language teaching, boat making, wine making, jelly making, renovation work. Well, you're interested in getting into vinegar making. And you're also working in the vineyards. You're not just going to wine shows and making the wine in the cellars. You're actually out tending the vines as well. Do you have any limits besides, and also writing and importing all this stuff to Canada? I mean, do you ever find that you have taken on so much that you don't know which direction to turn, or is this how you operate? You just thrive on the variety?
I thrive on variety, but time is my limit, for sure. One of my favorite things about winemaking, and now one of my favorite things about Gamma, my food company, because, you know, I get to design the labels, I get to do administration work and communication work, I get to do social and go to expos. I mean, it's all fun. But I also really love working in the vineyard, and unfortunately for me, that's the thing I have to start doing less of, because it's very time consuming, especially when you grow in Pergola. Everything has to be done manually, and it's how I really connected, I think, with the vines and the varieties that we produce. So I don't take that time in the vineyard for granted. I really love it. I love connecting with the plants, and it may seem all hooey, but I truly think it teaches you about the wines that you produce when you work manually with the vines. And unfortunately, because of all this other stuff I have to do, that's the thing that I can outsource the easiest, and probably will do less of this year. But I'll be there for sure in April. I'll be in the vineyard.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Okay, so you taught English to Italians, but tell me about your journey to learning to speak Italian. Would you consider yourself 100% fluent?
I would not consider myself 100% fluent, but to be honest, I've been pretty bad at studying in general. I've only learned from speaking it, so I'm pretty good. Like, I just did a B2 test and did really well on that. I would say I'm like C1, C2, always learning a new word, but feeling quite confident with it. I do most of my work in Italian, and I have several Italian friends that we only speak Italian, but then at the same time, my partner and I speak English together. So I've taken a slower route than going to school and studying it, which has been frustrating at times. I haven't been so great at that, but I feel really good now with where I am. But of course, we're talking about 10 years.
That's reassuring, I think, in some ways, for anyone moving here as someone currently struggling with Italian and feeling like it's not coming fast enough. It's nice to hear that giving yourself a 10-year window before you're at the level where you are right now is realistic.
Yeah, well, definitely you can do better than I did. You can study more than I did, because I truly only picked up a book like for a month. I was really lazy about studying Italian. I thought it would be easier. I got really stuck like year 4, 5. I was struggling a lot because I wasn't going over like A2, B1 kind of thing, you know, because I wasn't studying. Like, I can very clearly see how I could have made this life easier for me. But I think a big part of it has also been working expos. And my learning curve really was when I started having to leave the winery, because I could only do so much with the people I knew here who also knew English. You know what I mean? So is probably easier if you work outside your home to learn a language than working at home and speaking to the same 3 people all day, every day.
Well, there's a lot of people who would kill to be in your shoes and have the ability to speak Italian the way you do, no matter how you learned it. I think we're always our worst critics. Now, we've talked about some of the things that you love about this region. What are some of the challenges that you've faced in this region, and maybe some things that you noticed about the people that are maybe a little bit more on the challenging side for a foreigner?
I think this region is a little bit more closed than other regions from my experience in the south. Anywhere south of Rome and south of Rome, I find them a little bit more welcoming, trying to teach you or like bring you into, even if it's their shop, or, you know, they're trying to bring you into the culture a little bit more than here. It's a little bit colder, like you don't get it, you're not with us kind of vibes. So I find it a little bit cold, but that also comes with some of its pros. I have to say that it's German influences and how clean it is here and how well run it is here. It's definitely less chaotic, and our transit systems work so well here compared to those in the South. No offense to the South. I love it there. I want to buy a house in Sicily. But they're definitely a little bit more rigid here, I would say. But my partner's family is Roman, so I have a little bit of flexibility there, that their culture is a little bit Roman influenced. The food is not typically Italian. I know when people came here to visit me from Canada, they were like, where's all my pasta con vongole? And I'm like, not in Trentino. It is goulash and polenta here. It's definitely northern foods. Alto Adige is a strong influence. And, you know, the Knederli, more like hearty dishes, definitely less pasta. Not typical Italian foods that everyone thinks they're coming to. But here also, I have to say, you need a license or to live right by a train because of all the everything spread out, as I was saying, which was such a positive thing, that there's so many communities and it's very populated while still being rural. At the same time, you need to drive to the supermarket and you need to drive to the Trento to go to the doctor or whatever it may be. You definitely need an ability or access to a car or the ability to drive. That's kind of a downfall unless you live like right in the town center. Oh, one of the negatives is probably the air quality. I mean, in Veneto, you probably understand some of the air quality issues. But at certain times of the year, so it's interesting that, like, you're in the mountains, it's the freshest air, it's all about nature, which it is. But then at the same time, air quality can be very poor depending on the wind systems and humidity during those periods.
Okay, good to know. I didn't realize that you were struggling with the same thing kind of further up in the hills and the mountains that we are here in Veneto. It's one of the things I don't like about this region. I like a lot of things about this region. Like you mentioned, everything is run very well. It's very efficient. But yeah, the air quality is definitely one of the few negatives for sure. Now, you just mentioned something I was going to ask you about. I happen to love the apples. I just love apples in general, and I happen to love the apples that are grown up there. Besides apples, what are some of the other crops that are grown in that area besides apples and grapes?
To be honest, it's just apples. It's just apples and grapes. It's a lot of apples and grapes. Otherwise, it's cabbage for krauti, for sauerkraut. There, of course, are small farms producing everything. I buy all my vegetables at a weekly market and they have almost everything all the time, you know, quote unquote, everything that's in season. No asparagus in the wintertime. But yeah, it is apples over there pointing to Val di Non, and it is wine grapes here. I live at the base of a mountain called Monte di Mezzacrona. You can take a funicular up and go up to 1,000 meters high. And you look around and there's not a single piece of land that doesn't have grapevines on it from what you can see. It is completely covered in grapevines. And maybe I'm going to kick myself after this, not thinking of something else that they cultivate, but it truly is apples and grapes. I forgot that we cultivate a hectare of small berries on top of the mountain. That would be red currant. Good thinking.
I love it. Okay, so a little bit of berries. I think I saw some strawberries and, like you said, some currant berries and maybe some raspberries and blackberries or others. But besides those crops, it's mainly the wine grapes and the apples. There's also a huge production of lumber in your region, isn't there?
Yes, yes. And that is a lot of maintenance as well, because the forests have to be maintained in a certain way so they don't erode and fall down. And so there is a lot of maintenance in the mountain, the Dolomites in general, which obviously produces lumber. We have a couple of lumberjacks that work here around the property on the mountain. And it's not like we take all of the wood from them. It's not worth it to sell.
During the course of this interview, you've been jumping up and checking your oven. You are baking something. What are you? Tell us what you're baking.
I'm baking sourdough bread. I'm baking sourdough bread because I always make 3 loaves a week. So it takes, 4 hours to bake those 3 loaves. So it's taken the course of this time to go through my bread, but I just took the last one out. Not that we were talking that whole time, but I took the last one out and I was late to the bread making. It wasn't actually during COVID, but then I took a course with a famous baker from a bakery in Trento, and he taught us how to make our own starter and things. So now that was my kombucha is my weekly chores.
So you make 3 loaves of sourdough bread a week. Mm-hmm. And you and your spouse sort of have interesting shared roles with the bread making. Tell me about that.
Yes, he takes care of the starter and works the bread and makes the bread, and then I bake the bread. So he just puts his hands up and walks away after it's been warmed into balls, and then it's my responsibility to time it right and hopefully it all works out. And I was surprised how they look because every sourdough loaf is different in this house.
Oh my gosh. Wine, grape jelly, sourdough bread. I mean, you must just like feel like a queen, the food that you are able to eat and drink. Now, there's one more thing that you and I were talking about before we started recording. And that is, I was asking you about your butter because I buy butter at the grocery store from up, in your region, sort of the Alps, and it's these supposedly grass-fed cow's butter. And you just mentioned that you do like butter, but you think that the butter from where is better?
Canada. It's one of the very few things that I think is better. Very few things, I have to say, but you know, when I was home for Christmas, I was like, Canadian butter is so good. And I was talking about it a lot. So then everybody started making me try the different butters that they had. And honestly, Canadian butter is great. And I stand behind Canadian dairy farming. My thing with butter is I really like salted butter. And even butter from Alto Adige is not salted. So I have to make it myself for it to be salted.
Okay, so you just mentioned that you just bought a butter churn and you're going to start on top of everything else that you're making and doing by hand. You're going to also start making your own butter.
Of course, yes. What else do you do when you can't find salted butter? And then I can use different salts. So I can have like a Maldon one. I can have like a Himalayan pink salt one. And I'll try all the different salts and I can do like sweet butters. I was thinking like cocoa or like herby, but like then you can put sugar in it. We could really get crazy. We could put like dried strawberries in butter. How yummy would that be? I don't know. I'm just snowballing here. I think I'm very excited about the butter.
Okay. I've got 2 requests. Okay. Number one, when you need somebody to come up and do a taste test and be an objective taste tester of your butter, sign me up. I'm a butter person, okay?
Of all my butters, well, you definitely have to get here to taste the wine from the source, and I will try to have more than one butter for you.
Okay. The other thing I want you to promise me is I grew up in California. We had the good fortune of having the Sierra Nevada mountains right there. And so I've been skiing since I was 7. But since I moved to Italy, I haven't put on a pair of skis and gotten onto the slopes even once, even though I live close to the mountains. So promise me that sometime you'll let me come and tag along with you to your favorite ski resort.
For sure. That would be amazing. I mean, we could go up to Paganella in 15 minutes from here and we could just get a 2-hour pass even, or like 3 hours. Or my trick is always you get a 2 or 3 hour pass and then at the last, like you take the last lift when the hour is finished. So then you ski to a restaurant and you get to have a restaurant, your a meal and a beer with the view. So you actually get that extra hour of being on the mountain, then you ski down.
I'm coming. I'm serious.
That would be amazing. Yes, you should. We've been told that there's no precipitation happening in the next 10 days, which does ruin my ski plans for the next 10 days. But it's always beautiful to go. Even if it's fake snow, it's not all real snow. No fresh snow. But I was just in Madonna di Campiglio, and it was incredible. And I said to myself, I have to go skiing at least 8 times this season. So you've got 8 opportunities with me. Really hoping for that precipitation to come, because we don't want just sun and plus 10 for skiing.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, I'm coming. You can count on it. Yes. I can't wait. That's going to be, I've been looking for a ski buddy, and I think I just found one. I'm so excited right now.
For sure. My partner and I love skiing. We love it.
Okay. So my Italian husband, Alessandro, does not ski, no interest in skiing. And so I have to find others that are interested. I think he would love to sit and drink espressos and have a nice time at like a ski lodge somewhere. That would make him happy. Yeah.
Well, he can go there, or he can stay here with the wine and we'll be back in 4 hours. We can do a whole day of it and then we come back to the wine.
I think he'd be fine with that too. That sounds great.
Be awesome.
What a delight this conversation has been. Your life, what a fabulous life. I hope you know. Sure, you must pinch yourself on a regular basis, but you must know that you're living kind of a really fabulous dream.
I appreciate that. I do know. I mean, but it is just the life, you know, there's good and bad things that happen every day to everybody. So as much as, you know, it's a dream for some people when they think about making wine, for example, but like not everybody will love actually making wine from sun up till sundown 40 days straight. But I enjoy living. And I love meeting people and talking about wine, and it's been such a pleasure talking to you. And I feel bad. I want to learn more about you now. So you really do have to come and just talk about you for an hour, because that's quite enough about me. You know more than most people. You come tell me about you now.
We'll save those conversations for when we're on the slopes. And just to be clear, I don't want to minimize and try to turn your life into some sort of under the Tuscan sun, you know, fairy tale moment. Like,
no,
I want to.
Truly is not.
Right, because you're living a reality. But I guess what I'm saying is I want to acknowledge how much you're working. You and your partner and your brother-in-law, you're working really hard. You're also just loving your work. And it's not just like this bed of roses.
In particular, winemaking has such a fantasy around it that when you say winemaking to some people, they just have this grandiose vision of, I don't know what they're envisioning, to be honest, because I didn't have it. I wasn't one of those people. So I'm not sure exactly what they're envisioning, but it's something along the lines of like stepping on a couple of grapes and then drinking a lot of wine, I think. And that is not it, but it is really fun to make wine in a totally different way.
You're right about that. I have a cousin that I absolutely love. He has a small winery in Sebastopol, California, which is in Sonoma County. And he makes some of the very best wine I've ever had the privilege of tasting. But it's a small production. He does a lot of the work himself. And when he comes to visit, I'll bring him up, and he would love to talk winemaking with you.
Cool.
I know. And you'll love Kurt. He is just incredible. And I see how hard it is. I mean, growing up in a farming family, I know that it's not some sort of an unrealistic fairy tale dream. It's a lot of hard work. It just also happens to be really rewarding.
For sure. And one of the good things about it is it has seasons. Every year, and I like how things change with the season. So, you know, the fall is our season where we lose our minds. You can't think about anything other than tanks and grapes and harvestates and sugars and acid, and you're going completely mad for 2 months, and then it slows down a little bit, and then it peaks back up when you do all of your barrel work and stuff, and then January and February are really chill, and then in spring it's like kind of coming alive again, so it's slow to start there, you know. It really comes in waves, winemaking, so that has also allowed me to start other projects.
Oh my goodness. Well, this has just been so much fun. I am so grateful. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing us about this region that honestly, we don't really have a connection to. So now you are, for many, many thousands of people listening to this, you are their connection to this region now. Thank you for being an ambassador to the region of Trentino Alto Adige.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure, really, to meet you and to chat with you. And I'm not sure about being a Trentino ambassador, but it is really cool here. So it's definitely worth putting on your list, traveling Italy or potentially moving here, whatever you're thinking about it. It really is a great place and a totally different side of Italy. So nice to meet you.
Likewise, truly, truly. I am very much looking forward to coming up, tasting some of that wine and getting to see this region through your eyes. I'm going to be dreaming about your butter and your sourdough bread tonight. I just know it.
Oh my God.
I'm going to be sharing links to everything that we've talked about today and anything we didn't even mention. I'm going to make sure I get all the links to put into this episode. There's also going to be an article coming out on All Roads Lead to Italy about everything that Victoria and the winery, everything. It's all going to be there. You're going to be able to follow her on social media, Instagram, everything. All the links are going to be there. So once again, Victoria, thank you for your time. I'm sure we'll be in touch very soon.
Thank you so much. It was really my pleasure. And I can't wait to hear your next guest and see what else is going on in Italy, because I probably have to go check it out.
Well, you are the third to the last. We only have the region of Val d'Aosta and Basilicata.
Cool. Val d'Aosta has some wild winemaking happening there. Some very cool stuff.
Absolutely. Victoria, please come back in the future and give us an update about everything that you're doing, okay?
I'd love to. I'll tell you all about my butter and my wine. But no, I'd love to be back anytime. It's been a real pleasure.
Fantastic. We'll talk soon. Ciao, ciao.
Ciao.
Are you craving some of that homemade butter, sourdough bread, and some of that fantastic wine from Trentino like I am right now? I feel like once I go up there and experience that world, I'm never going to want to leave.
Perfect, isn't it? It's like a fairy tale region. It's just out of this world. Okay, Trentino Alto Adige is the least Italian of the 20 Italian regions. There it is. Actually, I've always dreamt of moving to Trentino, especially Alto Adige. We will get there in a moment. So the northern part of this region, because it's just so perfect. But there are two reasons why I never did. And I moved to Tuscany instead. Well, first of all, the language. I don't speak German. And if I had to learn a new language, probably I would move really abroad, like further away. And I don't particularly love the mountains. I mean, it's great for a week, maybe two, but yeah, it's not me. I'm more for the rolling hills or the flat. But basically, Trentino Alto Adige, the whole region is beautiful. But you see, Trentino Alto Adige, you can already tell it has this double name, and Alto Adige, okay? It's also called Trentino Sud Tirol. So this region has two names, one in Italian, Trentino Alto Adige, and one in German, Trentino Sud Tirol. It's in the northern part of Italy, you figured that out. It borders Austria, Veneto, Lombardia, and Switzerland. So it's right up there. And it only has two provinces, Trento and Bolzano, Bozen. So you see, I'm saying a few things in two languages here because, yes, Trentino Alto Adige, it's one of the few regions in Italy with, you know, special laws and special rules. It's one of the regions a statuto speciale, so with a special legislation, very independent. But Trentino is even more independent, well, Alto Adige, and the province of Bolzano in particular, are even more independent than the other independent regions of Italy. Because, well, its very location right there, it's nestled between Austria and Italy, you know, it's a meeting point for the two cultures. And yet that area is sort of stranger to both. They're not Italian nor Austrians. They feel like they're both, but they're different. And the constant interaction between the Italian and the Austrian sides of the region gave life to this unique regional culture. So Trentino, well, of course, Trentino Alto Adige, it is one of 20 regions of Italy, but it's just so different. And I wish I knew more about it, but I don't, because I'm still Italian. So even when I go there, I don't know half of it, because it's like being abroad. Of course, there are translations in Italian, but it's not the same as being born and raised there. And so it's just so fascinating, okay? They have their own traditional costumes and dances and songs and their cuisine. It has this strong Austrian and, you know, Germanic influence. And then there's the language, as I was mentioning before. Now, we can divide the region in two areas, the province of Trento in the south and the province of Bolzano in the north. And the part in the north is called Alto Adige in Italian and Sud Tirol in German. And in Alto Adige, so Sud Tirol, 70% of the population has German as their first native language. Schools, there are Italian schools, I mean, schools in Italian and schools in German. And about 70% of students pick the German school because they come from German families. Trentino, on the other hand, so the southern part of the region, the province of Trento, basically, is characterized by the Italian language and, you know, Italian culture. So it's more Italian, it's more similar to Veneto or Friuli, while the northern part, it's like Austria. Okay, even the architecture is different, it's so different. Everything, especially in the Sud Tirol part, is written in two languages because there are the two official languages. Okay, Italian and German. And like, I don't know, Vipiteno, the town of Vipiteno, beautiful, is Sterzlini. So nothing to do with it. So obviously we feel abroad when we go there. Now, the main feature, I mean, geographical feature about Trentino Alto Adige is the Alps, le Alpi, okay? And the Dolomiti. How do you call them in English again? Sorry.
Dolomites, yeah.
Dolomites, okay, the Dolomiti. Now, Dolomiti are part of the Alps, okay, because I know it can be confusing, but the whole mountain range of the Alps, all the way from, you know, Piedmont to Friuli, is divided in areas, and the Dolomites are just a part of it in Trentino, and part of them are actually in Veneto, but let's say that in Trentino, there are so iconic because they're made of dolomite, which is actually a kind of rock, dolomite rock, and they're so special. They have these shapes and they're just so beautiful. Amazing ski areas there. I love it. You have the Dolomiti Super Ski Pass. You can buy the ski pass and ski for days without, you know, doing the same run twice. And it's also great in the summer because you have a lot of hikes and it's just so, so beautiful. So they're called Dolomiti and they're there, but a part of the Alps, right? Now, there are about 3,992, actually, so not about, but it's an exact figure. So 3,992 named mountains in Trentino Alto Adige. So that's a lot of mountains for a small region. The highest is the Ortler, which is almost 4,000 meters. That is almost 13,000 feet. And the most, you know, famous and, you know, unique for the shape is the Marmolada, which is just 3,000 and something meters above sea level. So that's 11,000 feet. But it's not only mountains, it's all the caves, the plateaus, and the lakes. All the lakes in Trentino, they come out of a fairy tale. And canyons and rivers and waterfalls and forests. It's just magical. And the towns, well, if you are in the province of Trento, they're like northern Italian. You know, they have this sort of European vibe, like Trieste, for example. You know, Trento is a beautiful city. I was there recently and I really loved it. While in Alto Adige, Südtirol, it's like being in Switzerland or Austria, of course. Even the shape of the houses, the wood, and you have the red flowers at the windowsill. It's just amazing. Now, obviously, it's still Italy, so it has a very long history, okay? Prehistorical times, yeah, there were people there. And then the Romans arrived, blah, blah, blah. As usual, the Romans. And, well, when the Roman Empire started to fall, basically, that territory became a sort of invasion corridor for all the barbarian peoples coming from the north, right? So still today, there's the Brennero Passage. It's the most famous one for all the tourists from, you know, Germany, Austria, Germany, and northern people, northern Europe in general. They might decide to come to Italy through the Brennero or all the other way from France. So you still have the invasion. You can see all these cars lying up in the Brennero. But because, you know, it's the only part in all the Alps where it was kind of easy to build roads. So even back then, it was already a passage. So you had all this barbarian coming. But the first invasors who actually settled in that area instead of keep, you know, walking down were the Bavarians. Okay, so literally the Germans from Bavaria, like Bavarian Monaco di Baviera. So basically what happened that the northern part of Trentino Alto Adige, so the northern part of the whole region, remained under the Bavarian domination for centuries, while the southern part was under French domination. There you go, we talk about France again. So France and Germany. Now, the whole Middle Ages, it was just a roller coaster of invasions and changes of domination. Basically, the Longobards, the French, and the German. But let's say that starting from the 1500s, the two territories actually progressed separately. Okay, Südtirol, that was Austrian, Germanic, Austrian, Hungarian, remember that Austria and Hungary were together in a single kingdom. So that sort of idea, while the south was basically Italy. Okay. Now, this kept going on and on and on after Napoleon, you know, back and forth, back and forth. And during World War One, after actually World War One, the region was finally reassigned to Italy, all of it. Okay. So this is Italy, World War One. But yeah, this caused irredentism. So people were against it and they protested because they didn't feel like they were Italian. And after World War II, well, then we went back to the other side. So it was all Austria. And finally, after World War II, Austria renounced the territory in favor of Italy. So it still said, okay, you're Italian, but there were still tensions. In 1969, a first agreement was reached, and finally Italy sort of conceded more independence to the province of Bolzano and the administration of Bolzano, Bolzen, and Alto Adige had a higher level of autonomy. However, the German-speaking minority only accepted the situation in 1992. That's when, finally, the Austrian parliament fully closed the South Tyrol issue and said, okay, we're done. 1992. See why I say that this region is the least Italian of all regions? Because 1992 was actually last week, right? So very complicated, but so, so beautiful. Now, a few fun facts about this region. Well, Trento and Bolzano, the two cities with the provinces, are always in the top of the charts for best quality of life. Mm-hmm. Like In Italy, the best ones are always Trento and Bolzano, are always up there, top three, top five. But weirdly enough, Bolzano is extremely hot in the summer. So don't worry if you love Italy because you love the sun. Well, Bolzano is really hot in the summer, kind of cold in winter, of course, it snows a lot. But yeah, you have the two seasons, all of them. And Trentino Alto Adige, so the whole region, is famous for its Christmas markets. So if you love Christmas, you have to go to Bolzano, Merano, Brunico, Bressanone, Vipiteno. Those are the most famous towns with the most famous Christmas markets. But every town in Trentino has one, and they are just the best. And you know, I told you that German and Italian are spoken there. Well, there's actually a third official language in Trentino Alto Adige, which is Ladino, Ladino with a D, not a T. So it's not Latin, but it's Ladin. It's a Romance language. It's spoken there, especially, I mean, on the Dolomites Mountains in northern Italy, part of South Tyrol, and part of the province of Belluno, that is in Veneto, by the Ladin people. So they even have this older version. And also in the Graubünden, so one of the parts of Switzerland, the one where Ladino is spoken, is sort of the same. So you see, up there on the mountains, there was this language only spoken there that still survives. And it's officially one of the three languages. Now, if you're worried about the language, you should be. I mean, if you want to move to Alto Adige, so the southern part of Trentino Alto Adige region, no problem. Italian is perfectly fine. If you really want to move to Alto Adige and you need to work there, for example, you'll need to learn German. I mean, there's no way around it. You can live there, of course, and just speak English and some Italian. But if you really need to be, you know, part of the working force or things like that, you might find people who do not speak Italian or English unless they studied it. So just as you know, it's, I mean, don't say, oh, I speak Italian, I'm fine, because yeah, they understand some Italian, but for most of them, Italian is not the first language. So that's very important to remember. Now, as we're speaking today, Nathan, as we are recording this, the Australian Open are happening in Australia, right? Tennis tournament. And tomorrow there will be the men finals. And do you know who's playing? The biggest tennis player of all time, Italian tennis player of all time, is number four right now in the world. Okay, he's ranked number four in the world, which is a very big deal for Italian tennis. We are so proud of him, even though he's so young. He's like 21, 22. No, it's very, very young, 24 maybe, but still young for tennis. And he's from super Italian Jannik Sinner from Trentino Alto Adige. You see what I mean? He's like our champion. We all love him. He plays for the Italian team and everything else. So he's 100% Italian, but his name is Jannik Sinner. And he has this auburn, like reddish hair and green eyes. And it's just, yeah, because he comes from a family in Alto Adige where, you know, German is their first language. He has a German name and so on. But yeah, we'll all cheer for him tomorrow, his first Grand Slam final. Now, there is too much to say about Trentino. I know I talked a lot, and this was one of the difficult regions, right? Difficult to find someone who moved there, an expert there. And I get it. I get why. I mean, it's amazing, but probably it's not Italy. I mean, Trento is, but the northern part in the Alps is not. So people who want to move to Italy, yeah, probably it's not their first choice because it doesn't look like Italy, but it is. So you have the best of both worlds, actually. But there are so many things, and while I was doing some research to prepare for this episode, I found things that I had no idea about, all with German names, mostly the ones I didn't know about, traditions and festivals and things. So it's really like different country. So I would love to tell you more, but I'm not familiar myself because it is Italy, but at the same time, it's not. And they are kind of, yeah, protecting their culture, and it's not as famous. I mean, you see how Alessandro is so proud of being from Naples, and all Napoletani are. And I talk about their city, and that, well, there are a lot of them. There are not so many people from Alto Adige, but still, they are sort of, I wouldn't say close because they're not, but yeah, up there. So you really need to go there and meet people and talk to them to really see this different world. And while you're there, don't forget to drink great wines. They have amazing wines and eat amazing food. So Mele del Trentino, we talked about this because you went apple picking in Trentino, in the part, you know, very close to Veneto. Well, cheese. They have a lot of amazing cheese, and I love puzzone di Moena. This is something so good. So Moena is a town, and puzzone means, oh, it stinks a lot, but it's an amazing cheese. And then they have, well, they're the one who invented speck. Do you know speck? It's like this sort of, yeah, prosciutto cured meat speck. And carne salada, which is sort of, yeah, not similar, but also, like a cured meat that is so, so good. And as for wines, they have, well, I'll just say two. Famous red, it's Lagrein, very good. And my favorite white, probably, Gewürztraminer. And it's like an aromatic wine with a German name, of course. Dishes, oh, I love it. When I went to Trento, I like spent 2 days, 3 days eating. Now, the most famous dish from Trentino is Knödelli. That's how we call them in Italian. The name in German is Knödel. And they're like big gnocchi, I would say, almost meatballs, gnocchi, and in between. They're very big and very good, and you eat them with some soup, like a little bit of stock on it. And you have all different kinds, you know, with cheese, with meat, and just so, so good. Knödelli. And then there are spezzle, that are small green gnocchi. And then you have Gröstl, that is a rosticciata. So it's like baby, basically meat with potatoes all together, and goulash soup. So you see, an Hungarian dish made its way all the way down to Italy. And this is just my favorite. I just made goulash last week, I guess I told you. We can consider it also Italian, sort of. And polenta and desserts. The most famous dessert from Trentino Alto Adige is strudel alle mele. So apple strudel and krapfen. Krapfen are like big, big pastries filled with custard and fried. Ah, now, even though it's sort of a small region and, you know, up there, not really Italian, but still Italian, you know, I could find songs and movies anyway, because it's so beautiful. So now, as for songs, I chose actually not a song, but, well, Trentino is so famous for mountain choirs. So there are a lot of choirs with people singing special songs for choirs. Traditional songs most of the time, and a lot of these songs are about World War II and even World War I. Okay, it's just part of the tradition. And I recommend, among all the songs, La Villanella by Coro della Sarte. So coro is how we say choir in Italian, della S-A-T, that's the name of the choir, and La Villanella is the song. So you get an idea of this tradition. You have choirs all over Northern Italy and the Alps, but the ones from Trentino are the most famous. And I'm not giving you a movie, but a whole brand new, I mean, it was, yeah, released in 2020, TV series on Netflix. So you will find it for sure, with subtitles in every possible language. And that is called Curon, C-U-R-O-N, and it's set in the town of Curon Venosta, so a city in Trentino Alto Adige, and most of the scenes were shot in Südtirol, so you have an idea of the area and what I'm talking about, because I didn't watch the TV series, but I know the places where this was shot, and they're just, wow, beautiful.
Well, that gives us something great to listen to and wonderful to watch. So thank you so much for sharing that with us, Vera. I'm always so fascinated with what you have to share. And after talking to Victoria and now hearing what you had to share, I realized that even though I've visited this region a few times, I haven't even scratched the surface of how much it has to offer. The good news is, Vera, the wine that you mentioned, La Grey, that wine is actually made by Victoria and Giulio's winery. So we will definitely, as she was talking to me about it during our interview, I was like, oh, I can't wait to go and taste some of their wine. So with just one more reason, we've got to go and taste your favorite wine up in Trentino Alto Adige, right?
Yeah, I'm so curious to taste their La Grain, because obviously every winery is a little bit different. And I really want to try that. So we need to visit them in Trentino.
That's right. Well, that brings us to our surrounding sounds for today's episode. But before we get into that, I'd like to take a quick moment to thank our sponsors. Babbel Language is a language program I've been using for the last year and a half. And I can tell you from personal experience, from someone who has tried all the popular language programs from Pimsleur to Rosetta Stone and Duolingo, by far Babbel Language is the best. This is a German company, and they have native speakers from 14 different countries creating very highly specialized language learning programs for each language, and Italian is no exception. They offer lessons to fit whatever it is that you need in the moment, whether it's just a listening lesson while you're walking, whether you have time to sit down and write something, speak something, or read something. They also have a wonderful podcast so that you can listen at whatever learning level you are at, whether you're a beginner, intermediate, or an advanced learner. I personally signed up for their lifetime membership, so I never have to pay for any of their languages that they offer again besides Italian. So when I'm ready to learn a new language, maybe French or Mandarin or Spanish, whichever language I want to focus on next, I'm able to do that for the rest of my life. The wonderful thing about Babbel is that with our link, our listeners get up to 50% off a lifetime membership. Now, they are making their lifetime membership a little bit more rare. So eventually they will probably phase out lifetime membership. I suggest you sign up for their lifetime membership while you can, so you never have to pay for a language learning app again. Visit imovingtoitaly.com, follow the links to Babbel Language, and thank you to them for sponsoring us today. Also, I'd like to take a moment to thank ExpressVPN. Now, recently I was traveling through the United States and Europe, and I was using public Wi-Fi, and I didn't have to worry about anyone that was on that same Wi-Fi network hacking into my computer or my phone or my tablet and stealing my data, which is something that can happen if you are using public Wi-Fi without the protection of a VPN. And you may ask, well, where would I ever be using public Wi-Fi? Well, in an airport, in a hotel lobby, in a cafe, even on a plane, your data can be accessed by another passenger on an airplane. With ExpressVPN, I also get to use my streaming services in whatever country I'm in. I was just in France, and I was using my streaming services from the United States. When I'm in Italy, I do the same. The great thing about a VPN is it tricks your device into thinking that it's in whatever country you need it to be in. So for example, when I was in Paris recently, I was able to trick my phone into thinking that I was actually in Italy, which meant I was able to use my Italian cellular data, and my phone never realized that it was out of Italy. So I wasn't charged any data roaming fees, which was excellent. Another excellent advantage of a VPN service, and ExpressVPN is the best, is you're able to use your streaming services wherever you are. You may not realize this, but Netflix, Hulu, HBO Max, Amazon Prime, they do not work the way they would normally work in your home country while you're traveling, because there are different licensing agreements in every country. If you want to watch the same shows and have access to the same programs on your streaming services while you're in Italy or anywhere in the world while you're traveling, you will need a VPN telling your device that it's okay, this device is in the home country, where it's registered. It's really a game changer. There's very few things that offer security, freedom, and peace of mind while traveling, like a VPN does, at less than $9 a month. And the wonderful thing is that by signing up for ExpressVPN on our website at imovingtoitaly.com, you're not only supporting our show, you also get 3 months for free when you sign up. Check out ExpressVPN and thank you to them for sponsoring us today. If you're looking for the very best Italian language coach, look no further than our very own Vera Sarzano, our co-host here on I'm Moving to Italy. Vera is a language expert. She speaks 7 different languages. She regularly translates books into English from Italian and into Italian from English. We are so fortunate to have her here. You can sign up for either private lessons or group lessons on Vera's website at chichelanguage.com. That's chichelanguage.com. If you're feeling stuck and overwhelmed about the idea of moving to Italy and you just simply don't know where to start because you feel like your unique situation is maybe more complicated than most and you just don't know if this is something that will work for you and you would like to do some discovery calls, or maybe you're halfway through the moving process and you're stuck on something and you just can't seem to find the right answers, maybe you just need a little bit of therapy, so to speak, about moving. I can tell you, as someone who moved to Italy and has been spending time in Italy for the past 10 years, Italy is not an easy place to just pick up and move to. There are a lot of complications. There are a lot of mistakes that can be made if you don't do the right thing. There can be lasting consequences that can inhibit your ability to live the life that you really want in Italy. Allow someone who has moved to Italy and made some of those mistakes to help you along the way. And that someone is yours truly. Not only do I have an entire network of professionals that I can help you with, real estate experts to tax experts, language experts, I personally will help you to get past whatever it is that's getting you stuck or confused or keeping you from realizing your dream of moving to Italy. Reach out to me directly at imovingtoitaly.com. Follow the links to coaching with Nathan. There's a questionnaire that will take you about 10 minutes to fill out, and it will help you and me to understand what your starting point is before we start coaching together. Now, for the last year, I've had the privilege of coaching many of you and getting many of you unstuck and successfully moved to Italy, purchase property, become a tax resident, become a legal resident, get your citizenship, find a dentist, figure out how to set up your phone. There are so many complicated things that if you've never done it before, you just don't know where to begin. Let me be your guide. Let me be your sort of moving to Italy therapist. It's my pleasure. I have some availability during the week as well as on the weekends. So reach out to me, fill out my questionnaire, and I'd be happy to set up some time to meet with you. I do 70-minute sessions. Those sessions, which cost about the same amount as if you were to hire a good therapist to help you with any other personal problem, will help you to move forward. I suggest that you sign up for at least 3 sessions, whatever works for you. I've had people that have weekly sessions with me for months. It just depends on what your situation is. Reach out to me, coachingwithnathan at imovingtoitaly.com, and I look forward to helping you move to Italy. Speaking of these choirs from this wonderful region, our surrounding sound today is going to be a choir singing music from this region. And I have to say, it's really, really spectacular. I can see why this music is so famous and why these choirs are famous all over Europe, but especially Italy. So here is a surrounding sound from the region of Trentino Alto Adige, a local choir singing some local music from that region. Enjoy, and Vera and I will be back afterwards to say goodbye.
Si sente cantare.
Well, for being the most un-Italian region of all, I have to say that the region of Trentino Alto Adige has so much to offer and is officially one of the most interesting regions we've ever visited here on the podcast. Wouldn't you agree, Vera?
Absolutely, because it's the most unexpected.
Yeah, and I love unexpected things. And like I mentioned a couple times, the most unexpected delightful experience I had with today's guest, who is, I can already tell, going to be one of my favorite Italian expat friends here in Italy. She is just fabulous, and I am so much looking forward to going up and visiting her beautiful winery and getting a little taste for this wonderful region of northern Italy. Vera, thank you so much for sharing all of this interesting, fascinating, and unusual information about this region with us today.
Thank you, and I can wait to be here again next week for our second to last episode for this season.
I know. I'm not sure which region it's going to be yet, Basilicata or Val d'Aosta. I guess we'll find out in our next episode. But until then, Vera and I hope you are healthy and well wherever you are listening to the sound of our voices today. And we look forward to being back here with you next week for another episode. So until then, take care. God bless. Ciao, ciao, ciao.